it's good that there are a couple of rabbis in the room because they'll appreciate this. Apparently, the reason that the rabbis created the Arba Parshiot was to avoid Vayikra and these kinds of I'd love to talk about this week's Parsha, but what can I do is Parshat Zachar, and Parshat Zachar is arguably a Doraita. When I say it's arguably a Doraita, almost everybody agrees that Zachar is a Doraita. It's not so simple that the way to fulfill a Doraita is by going to Shul and hearing Kriyat Torah with a minyan. It could be that Zachar could be accomplished many other ways. Even, by the way, this year we can accomplish Zachar by remembering, and there's two different sections of the Torah primarily that deal with Zachar, that deal with Amalek. And the Magen Avraham has a big chiddush that people think it's a big chiddush that he says you can read the other one. Now that itself is funny because you don't know which is the other one. The one that we read is the retrospective, which is in Devarim, which goes back and tells the story again on a retrospective way. Yeah, and by the way, remember and don't forget. But what do you just remember, not forget? You just remember, not forget the other one. And the other one is that which actually happened. Not to remember the remembering, remember what actually happened. And that is Zachar as real time, as the war against Amalek, which takes place in Bishalach. What's interesting is that this is a larger issue, which I'm really not going to address today. I want to get to one really specific point. But the larger issue is really the place that they're both sit in the Torah. Now you'll say, what do you mean the place that they both sit? Well, at least the first one you'll say is not an issue because that's exactly when it happens chronologically. And any of you who think a little bit about Rashi throughout Sefer Shemot, you should say, oh yeah, that's not really an explanation because nothing's really chronological. So that could be placed. And again, it's interesting that Yitro is placed immediately afterwards. And the story of Yitro, according to many, doesn't take place at that point, which means if you're following with me, chapter 18 does not necessarily place, or at least half of chapter 18, Vayima Macharat, when Moshe is judging the people based on what is he judging the people. So theoretically, that's based upon information that he hasn't yet to receive. So therefore, you know, right then you have this problem of when things were put in, and then chapter 19, you have the preparation for Har Sinai, which again, by the way, you also have in chapter 24, which is part of the challenge. But in chapter 19 is where we have that famous Rashi, because it changes the terminology from the plural to the singular, where they travel in plural, and they arrive in plural, and then they encamp, and it's in singular, and there Rashi says that they are completely unified. So I'll say something which I think is important this year and for now, and I can ask where does that, because other years we would say it differently. Other years we would say it like this. We'd say, why was there unity? And it's obvious. There's all the drashot. There's unity because there's Matan Torah, and people are so overwhelmed accepting the Torah, the Nasa and the Nishma, and so on and so forth, and therefore there's complete unity accepting the Torah, and that's all very nice. As I said, I would say that other years, but I'm not going to say that this year. This year I'll point out that this comes immediately after a war, and war tends to bring about unity. And therefore, when you realize the juxtaposition, and again, the chronological, according to, and now if you put together all the sources, the Seder Olam Rabbah and so on, you'll end up that Melchamed Amalek took place on the 27th and 28th of Iyar, Yom Yerushalayim, which is really interesting. And there's 2 days for the battle, which I will come back to and try to note. And then you have them arriving on Rosh Chodesh. So it's a question of 1 or 2 days later, then there's still this incredible sense of unity. And maybe that needs to be understood a little bit better as well. That according to Rashi, and again, this is following the Rashi's, I'm sorry if that's the plural or not, there's one Rashi. But if you follow the different comments of Rashi, both in Bishalach and in Devarim, then something interesting emerges. That on the one hand, who is attacked? So it says those because we have a cloud, the Ananei HaKavod, right? Anybody who needs a Dvar Torah for Sukkot, okay, here you go. So it's the Ananei HaKavod. So what happened to the Ananei HaKavod? I mean, should we be suing for malpractice? Like, what happened to your malpractice? You're supposed to be protecting us. What happened? So Rashi tells us that there were certain people who were niflat. They were kicked out of underneath. Why? Because of the sins that they had. Which therefore means that those who were attacked are the ones who were the weakest people spiritually. It's also interesting that when Rashi notes that Moshe says to Yeshua, choose people, he says, tzadikim im yirat shamayim, which means that they sent the yeshiva students out to fight, to go and to protect all those people who were not necessarily following the laws that they should. And anybody who's listening will understand what I'm saying, and which is perfect because everyone's going to understand something else, but that's what I had in mind. And that is a really interesting thing, which means if you want to put it in contemporary terms, it means that the war against Amalek, and again, in Shemot, it's God is saying, it's my war against them. In Kitetze, it's interesting because then it becomes the Jewish people's war. And maybe that's the question of what we need to remember, who exactly is supposed to fight. I'm sure I've told this before, but many years ago, there was this young woman who I knew, who her father was a teacher of mine, who's Big Talmud Chacham, and Yori Yori, Yadin Yadin from Rav Moshe. And so that she'll know who she is if she ever hears this. And she went on a shidduch date. And top yeshiva guy and everything. And she was really very special. And the guy says the following, asks the fine question. If you met a little kid, again, you can argue blonde hair, blue eyes, with a t-shirt that says Amalek on him, would you kill him? So essentially it was a trick question. It's a trick question. If you say yes, he say, what kind of woman are you? If you say no, what kind of Jew are you? So essentially he was... So she answered that according to the Rush, the mitzvah of Muhammad of Amalek is not on women, it's only on men. So I'd bring him to you and see how you do. And then she didn't agree to go out with him again. She married a big Talmud Chacham, a very nice fellow, and so on. But I love the story because who really is the mitzvah on, and when is it on, and at which point is this mitzvah? I mean, Jews get. I mean, it's very good the mitzvah to remember and to read it in shul. We get very excited and we read it multiple times. Zecher, again, we do funny things. Which, by the way, I don't know if you know this. Before the Mishnah Berurah, as far as we can tell, there was no one who read it twice. There's an argument how to read it. But I mean, some read it one way, some the other way, and there is a right way and a wrong way, which is really not nice to say. But by the way, Rav Soloveitchik would do this in Shema. Sorry, in Ashrei, Zecher Rav Tucha, he read it twice afterwards because you never know. And that gave birth to something which was really interesting. So we're really good at talking about it. We're really good at reading it and remembering it. As far as actually getting involved in wars, that sometimes becomes a little bit more challenging. Nonetheless, we have something interesting that those who were attacked were the ones who were the, today's world they would say, the off the derech, the ones who were kicked out, the ones who we did not include within the community. And essentially, the Anani HaKavod, God is saying, you're outside of the community. And then they're vulnerable and they get attacked. And then God says, now you go to war to protect them, which means I can kick them out, but they're still your brothers. I mean, there's something which is really, really interesting about that dynamic. And I think that, but this is what's funny. We all became the mitzvah of listening to every word of reading Zachor, but we don't think about what it really means. The other thing, which is, again, really interesting, is that when Moshe has to choose somebody, he chooses Yeshua. And in case you don't know, this is the introduction of Yeshua. We don't know Yeshua before this. I mean, we'll meet him most, again, a couple times along the way, but we'll meet him by the Chayt Egel, we'll meet him going up to Har Sinai, we're going to meet him by being one of the Meraglim, and they were going to say his name is Hoshea ben Nun, and Moshe called him Yeshua, but he calls him Yeshua over here. One of the things that happens when he gets called Yeshua is his name becomes Yud Hey Vav. You have almost God's name, which is incomplete, which is really interesting in terms of the conclusion of the story of Amalek over here, that the throne is incomplete, the kisei is incomplete, God's name is incomplete, and over here you have somebody who has God's name, but it's incomplete, is leading the battle. But that apparently is not really the reason why Yeshua is chosen. You need a little bit of other sensitivity to know why he's chosen, and that is you look at the four characters who are involved. On the one hand, you have Moshe Rabbeinu, and Moshe at that point is Moshe. Moshe probably has a halacha of the melech, and his halacha of a kohen gadol, and his halacha of the manhig, and whatever you want. He's a malach, anything you want, that's Moshe Rabbeinu. The fact that we never made Moshe more than he is, and the fact that we did the opposite, we accused him of every, even last week's parsha, of miscounting the vavim, right? Right. Yeah. And again, so it's great how, you know, we keep our leaders down to earth. And keep reminding them that they're down to earth. On the other hand, you have Aaron, who's the Kohen Gadol, and then you, again, that's what's interesting. You have Moshe, who was a Kohen Gadol, and Moshe, who was a king, and then you have Aaron, who will become Kohen Gadol, and Hur, the man who should be king. who would be king but never became king because he's from Yehuda, which means essentially follow the tribes. What you have is the two people from Levi, and then you have someone from Yehuda and someone from Yoshua, who's from Ephraim, who's from Yosef. So therefore, the fact that it's Moshe and Aaron, so that's easy because Moshe and Aaron are the ones who were chosen for the very beginning. Maybe Aaron more, maybe less, but that we can debate. But then the two that stand out, of course, are going to be from Yosef and from Yehuda. So that right away should remind you, it depends if you want to go backwards or you want to go forwards. You want to go back to the end of Bereshit, those are the two that stand out, Yosef and Yehuda. You want to go to the Meraglim, those are the ones who stand out from Yosef, from Yehuda. So therefore, none of this should be surprising if you're paying attention, but of course now you have to ask yourself a different question. And what's the different question? The different question is, why specifically is somebody from Yosef the one who's going to fight? And if you paid attention to Rashi, you can go back to Rashi in Tvayetze. As soon as Yosef is born, there it says that Yosef is born, and then the pasuk continues, and Yaakov says to Lavan, okay, I want to go now. So Rashi says, because Sitno, that's an interesting word from the word Satan, Sitno of Esav was born. What does it mean, Sitno Shelev? It's not someone who's satanic. It's very, very different. What word do you want in English? It's the adversary. That's the word over there. The adversary of Esav is here. So why is he the adversary? So I once saw a grape shot. I know I've said this before. I saw a grape shot in a book which is called A Total Yitzchak from Yitzchak Karo. Do you know who Yitzchak Karo was? I know you can guess, and you'll be half right. So Rav Yosef Karo grew up in his house, and he grew up, you know, sitting at his dining room table, and he grew up with it, but he's not his father. It's his uncle. Rav Yosef Karo's father passed away, and his uncle, Rav Yitzchak Karo, adopted him, took him in. So this is a major influence on Rav Yosef Karo, and he writes in the Talmud Yitzchak, and I'm spinning it a little bit, this is not a word for word, but this is really what he says, is that when Esav will debate the other brothers at some point in the future, you know, Esav can say, you know, why you have all this hatred towards Yaakov? You know what Yaakov did to me. And, you know, why do you have, you know, hatred towards your brother? Oh, you don't know what Yosef did. So there's hatred over there and nobody behaves. He goes, but then Yosef comes up and says, okay, Esav, tell me, okay? You know, lay down on the couch, tell me, what did your brother do to you? He took away the Bechora that you never wanted, right? But Yivez Esav at the Bechora. He detested the Bechora. It was a responsibility on him. He never wanted this. Oh, so he gave you a bowl of cholent for something you never wanted, right? So what are you talking about? This was like the perfect deal that you made. And Esav was very happy about it. Later, he may have had some seller's regret, but at the time, he's very, very happy about what had happened. So therefore, the anger that Esav has, okay, he dresses up at him, but that's probably still the implications that Yaakov is now the Bechor. And again, this is going to be important. Oh, this is just an introduction now. May take most of the time, but this is the introduction. But Yosef is the one who the brothers threw out of the camp. He's the one who's mechutz l'machane. He's the one who's thrown out from tachet kanfei Yashchina. He's the one who's off on his own. So who's a better person to go and to protect the people, the Jews who were kicked out, than somebody like Yosef, which means, but there's another part of it. How does Yosef then answer to Esav, according to this Toldos Yitzchak? How does he answer? He said, you know what my brothers did to me? My brothers, they stripped me naked, they threatened to kill me, they sold me off as a slave, and now Esav's getting excited, so how do you get him back? He goes, well, I gave them homes, and I gave them food, and I took care of them for 80 years. Why? Because they're my brothers. Which means that part of the whole story of Amalek is that we do have to protect our brothers. That's the takeaway of the story. So if I were a real rabbi, I would say, and nobody's Yotzei Parshat Zachar unless they understand the real meaning of it. But apparently nobody ever said that. They just want you to read it and have kavana. So you have read it and have kavana to be mochad. But come on, let's pay attention to what really the story is and don't miss the message, because it's very easy. So, having said all that, now we could begin. The story of Amalek, as I started telling you the context, so the context is they get to Har Sinai and now there's unity. So why is there unity? Because if you unify with the ones who you've kicked out and you bring them back and you go to war for them and you fight for them, you understand why there'll be unity. Because you just now created unity. This, as I said, this is for this year. But how does the whole story begin? The whole story begins, and that's why, and again, you really need to read all of Perek Yud Zayin, which we're not doing, is we have once again another water crisis or food crisis. So the Jews leave Egypt and they have matzah with them for 30 days. By the way, in my house, if we serve matzah for 30 days, that would be a food crisis. But they're eating matzah for 30 days. And the water that they find is bitter, so then Moshe sweetens the water. They run out of man 30 days later. Sorry, they run out of matzah 30 days later, and then the man starts to fall. But the water runs out. They need water. So that's where we're here over here. The people start complaining about water. Moshe says to God, you know, these people still are going to stone me. And by the way, notice something. Moshe's death is all going to be because of this. I know that it's not this. I know that it's going to happen later on. But it's right in Parshat Chukat, but it's because of this. This is the setup. It's a setup. Here God says, oh, take the staff and hit the rock. And there he says, take the staff, but speak to it. This is the setup, which means Moshe is still, they're going to kill me soon. Yeah, they're going to kill you soon. And there's actually a real hint of this. At the end of the whole section, God says, tell Yehoshua that this is what he needs to do when he faces Amalek. Well, where's Moshe? Is it Moshe going to lead the entry trail? There's already foreshadowing over here. It's not nice to think about it, but it's really staring at you. But what do the people say? The people say, we have no water and you took us out of Egypt to die. Why do you want us to die? So I just want you to keep in mind that, and now we can begin. Hineni omed lefanecha sham al atzur b'chorev. I know that's something we never notice, right? Is that the place that Moshe is standing at that point, where God is telling him where the water is going to flow, v'kita b'tzur, where's the rock that Moshe hits? It's b'chorev. So whether Chorev and Sinai are identical, or whether Chorev is the mountain range and Sinai is a particular one, I can't tell you. But it really is interesting that Chorev already is introduced in this story. Of course, Chorev, no pun intended, is a double-edged sword. Okay, pun intended. And, on the one hand, the Torah is going to come from there. On the other hand, your obligations and responsibilities and following the letter of the law is going to come from there. So it's interesting there. V'ikita b'tzor v'yitzu v'menu mayim v'shata ha'am v'yas kein Moshe le'nezik ne'Yisrael. And Moshe does this and the people see it, the elders see it. V'yikor shem v'kom maso mi'riva o'riv b'nei Yisrael v'anaso tamat Hashem le'mor hayesh Hashem v'kirbenu mayim. Is God with us or not? Which means at that point, the people, this is what everybody says, you just have to channel your inner Chassidish Rebbe now, is that the people developed within them doubts. That's what it is. Is God with us or not? The way that you say doubt in Hebrew is a safek. Safek in Gematria is Amalek. So therefore, when we have entered into our religious crisis, and again, now if you want to say, now the people complaining theoretically are the ones who have the doubts, or the ones who are now outside of the camp, and they're the ones who are going to be attacked by Amalek. I'm going to say yes, the context does make a difference because it just makes the whole narrative a little bit more interesting. So Amalek arrives and they wage war. And again, this is the introduction of Yeshua. Choose for us men. V'tzehi lachem ba'amalek. Machar anochi nitzav arosh ha'givah. U'matei Elokim b'yadi. And again, part of my question is, which mountain is he standing on? Is Moshe really standing on Mount Sinai or one of the hills of Chorev when he is involved in this particular battle? So we're not told, but again, you just have to realize this follows the previous verse. Now, there's a problem with what I just now read. Not really, because I read it right. But the reason I read it right is because I know the trup, at least in a rudimentary way. At least I know where that nachta is, so I know where you take a breath and where you pause. So the way that you read it is you divide the verse into two halves. But, right, what are the two halves? Right, the two are pasuk tet. V'yomer Moshe Yeshua, b'char lanu anashim v'tzei lachem b'amalek. Gather people and go fight. Why? There's a war going on. And then it continues, Machar, and tomorrow, Anochi Nitzav Rosh HaGivah Umatai Elokim B'yadi. And tomorrow, I'll go up to the mountain, and the staff of God in my hand, that just now did the previous miracle, that just now brought the water, and hopefully everything's going to work out. In source number two, we're told, I know we're still in the middle of one, we're told in the Mechilta. Mechilta is an ancient rabbinic source. Machar anochi nitzav rosh ha'giva, umat elokim b'yadi. Machar niyem utadin va'omdin na rosh ha'giva, According to some, this is the source for Tanit Esther. Although, by the way, those who don't know what Tanit Esther, if you're fasting today, has no source. It's not. Don't give me that look. You're giving me that look. It's not written in Megillat Esther when they fast for 3 days. That's on Pesach. Right, the whole story takes place on Pesach. It's not written in any place in Megillat Esther. It's not written in any place in the Mishnah. It's not written in any place in the Gemara. It's the earliest we find it from the time of the Gaonim. And it's actually against the Gemara. I'm sorry for saying that. It's against the Gemara because there's an ancient text called Megillat Ta'anit. So there's an argument if it still has authority or not. Megillat Ta'anit says you're not allowed to fast the day before Hanukkah or the day before Purim. If you can't test the day before Purim, then I can tell you that in Bayit Sheni, they did not fast Ta'anit Esther on the day before Purim. Okay? No discussion over. There's nothing to talk about because that's what it says, Megillah Ta'anit. So now, what do you have to go and do? Are you going to go out for breakfast after this? I'm saying all this and I'm fasting. I'm just telling you that. What can I do? You know? Like Tevye? Remember Tevye? Tradition, that's what we do. But in this particular case, if anybody says to me, you know, I'm not feeling, you can eat, drink. It's fine because it's the lowest level of any of the fasts because even the other fasts are written in Navi. Now the question is what authority they have. This suddenly appears, and I'm going to say it again. It's against, they could not have done it earlier based upon the sensibilities of the halacha in Bayit Sheni. So therefore, at which point does it emerge? So we find the time of the Gaonim. So now they start looking, where does it come from? So some point to this mechilta to say, oh, look, by the way, this has nothing to do with Purim, right? They say, look, when you go and fight against Amalek, what do? You fast. So therefore, the day before they celebrated Purim, there was a war, they must have fasted as well. By the way, did that work for any of you? But I'm saying, that's pretty good as far as the arguments. So first of all, the Mechilta said that, no, they had a fast day on that day. That's how one responds, one fasts. Then it continues, right? And it goes into this thing about mountains and hills being the Avot and the Imahot, which is used by commentaries in all kinds of other places. This is the source. Rosh Elamase Avot, Hagiva Elamase Imahot. So just realize that as a theme, hills and mountains and hills, are used that way, but this is where it comes. Isi ben Yehuda Omer. Isi ben Yehuda said, Chamishad Vrim Yesha Einlem B'Torah Hachra. There are five different sources or texts in the Torah that we don't know how to read them. Is it Machar Anochi Nitzav Rosh Hagiva? Oh, is it Tzei Hilochem Amalek Machar? Or is it go and fight against Amalek tomorrow? So, essentially saying, what's the key word here? Tomorrow. By the way, that's the title of today's class. Tomorrow. Not from Annie. Tomorrow. And the question over here is, does tomorrow go on the first part of the verse? Does it go to the second part of the verse? Is we're going to pray tomorrow? Or is it that you're going to go and fight tomorrow? So now, again, just imagine, wars in those days are very much hand-to-hand combat. Those who are outside of the camp were susceptible. Those are the ones who were attacked. So I don't know if they were killed or injured or whatever, but now, or captured. So now, at which point are we going to respond and then wage that counterattack? So therefore, it could be Moshe says, immediately go. Or it could be, well, actually Moshe said, go and find people, which itself indicates some kind of level of organization. So maybe it really does mean go and organize, get the people, and go fight them tomorrow. So there, but either way, I'm going to stress this again, tomorrow is a thing. So many people know this, what I'm about to say. The Maharal, I think, is the one who made it famous, but the earlier source is in source number 3. Did we read enough in the first one? We'll go back to the first just to complete this. Tomorrow is the question. V'yas Yeshua kasher amar lo Moshe lechem b'malek, u'Moshe Aaron v'chor lo Rosh HaGiv'ah. When Moshe would lift his hands. Now, all that is interesting. You do realize that, right? Okay, I have to spell out everything. Yes? When the people say that we don't have any water, we're going to die. So they're articulating something. It'll be very clear in a second. And again, that what they're articulating or who they're imitating or who's the ventriloquist over here is really important, but hold on to that. Because there's somebody else who spoke like that we need to identify. what happens immediately afterwards is Amalek. By Amalek, Yeshua is told to take arms, to take a cherev. So therefore, we're going to be using what we can call, we're going to be using what we can call is the Yadayim of Esav. That means Yaakov is being called to use the Yadayim of Esav. That's really interesting. Because what does Esav say when he comes in from the field and he's all tired, he wants food? He says, give me food, I'm going to die. Why, I'm going to die. So over here, the people are saying, give me food, I'm going to die. So therefore, who are they talking like? They're talking like Esav. So you're talking like Esav, who suddenly emerges right afterwards. Amalek comes. Is there a god or is that not a god? Which means, if you read at least midrashically, and you don't have to work that hard, you can actually read the text, of that section of Yaakov and Esav, it's really interesting because we're sounding now like Esav, but now we have to dress up like Esav, right? Like Yaakov did, and now we have to go fight. And who do we have to fight? We have to fight Esav. And Yeshua, specifically Yeshua, has to take a sword. Now, this is what's interesting about Moshe. Moshe goes up to the mountain in order to pray. But he's praying with his hands. Which means the Yadayim of Yaakov are now going to be used as well on the mountain. And there's this wonderful two different scenes taking place. Us needing to channel to fight because when Amalek attacks us, we have to fight back. But now we're on their battlefield. We're using their tools. We're using the cherev over here, which is connected to Esav. But on the other hand, we need to now to channel the Kol Yaakov in order to be victorious. So it's really interesting about Moshe lifting his hands. By the way, you won't see any Jewish artists really making pictures of this because it will look too much like a crucifix. And that's certainly one of the sources where that literary invention called Christianity comes from, where they try to put Jesus in a crucifix position because they want to make him look like Moshe up on the mountain. So, let me now continue, because maybe I got your attention by this point. See what happens that I don't get my coffee? In the morning? Hold everything, the whole world looks different. So let's continue. And it says, Vahaya, right? What is it? Go up to the top of the mountain. Pasuk Yud Aleph. I'm in one. We'll get to three. Belina dear. Vahaya kashayir, yirim Moshe yadova gvar Yisro, kashayir niyach yadova gvar Amalek. So I'm saying it's so interesting because Moshe is involved in prayer, but his hands are being used. But this is a different way of using the hands. V'yidei Moshe kvedim. V'yichu evin v'yisimu tachtav v'yeshev aleha. V'aron v'chur tamchu b'yodav mizeachad v'yodav emuna ad bo ha-shemesh. And so the interesting thing again here is faith, which is re-entering into the story, because the faith was questioned right before. You know, what are we going? You know, is there God or is not now God? And now faith comes back in. V'yomer Hashem. What else? V'yichlosh Yoshua et Amalek ve'et Amolo ficharev. Yeshua weakens them. Vayomer Hashem Moshe, Tov Zot Zikaron B'Sefer. So here you already have a Parshat Zohar. Remember, the symbol is Ne Yeshua. But that's what's interesting, that Yeshua is the one who's going to continue this. Kimachom Chot Zecher Malach Mitachat Hashemayim. And God says, I am going to get rid of Amalek. Vayove Moshe Mizbeach Goshma Hashem Nisi. Vayomer Ki Yad Al Kes. That's the Kisei is imperfect. Yah, which means God's name is imperfect, and that's what Chazal say, is that God's manifestation, God is perfect, but God's manifestation on this earth are imperfect as long as the people like Amalek who fight wars against God and question God's existence. Milchama laHashem b'Amalek midor dor. And if you need to know that the amount of psukim of the gematria of Yad Emunah, Siman Sina'ah, which is also quite interesting. So let us get now to source number three. Source number three, as I said, people have heard this, they know this, but this, as far as I can tell, is the source for it. Where Amra lo Esther, yes, we just now, of course, we jumped to Purim, of course, we jumped to the Megillah. Ima la melech tov, l'teta tshelati v'lasot et bakashati, yavo melech v'man, hayom ela mishteh. Right, Marata Esther Lomar Umachar Eser Kedvar HaMelech, which means that subsequently there is a machar in this story. Why push it over? Now, Pshat is easy. Esther's looking for her opening. She doesn't find it yet, so let's push it off to tomorrow. But what does the Midrash here say? Midrash Sifri Dagadatal Esther. Midrash Panim Acharim. And again, it's from the same collection that you mentioned before, the Abba Gurion. It's the same Elo shekol zaro shel Amalek limudim heim lipol b'machar. When does I am in three. I'm in three. When does Amalek fall? They fall tomorrow. By the way, this is so great. That means that Amalek keeps beating us up today, but we win tomorrow. The question is, does tomorrow ever arrive, right? But this is really interesting. We're going to beat Amalek tomorrow. And you know what the best part about this is? You know, really the best part. We believe it. I'm saying that's the best part. We believe it. We have Amunah. We have Amunah. Which means the very belief, if we're not hearing me yet, the problem that makes us susceptible to Amalek is that we start having safek, sveikot, lack of Amunah, is God with us or not. We have this battle against Amalek and we believe that we're going to win. When are we going to win? We're going to win tomorrow. But we always believe we're going to win tomorrow and we walk around with this faith because we believe in tomorrow. That's part of, that itself is part of the victory against Amalek because we believe in tomorrow. But I'm just pointing out now that this midrash is already telling us, Machar is a thing. And when we went back to the Mechilta and the Mechilta said, oh, I'm not sure where the tomorrow goes in that sentence, that's not an accident. Tomorrow is really an important element in this. So give me, and then it goes through in this Midrash, all kinds of other places where Machar comes in interaction with Amalek. And again, we can read the, one second, we can read the rest of it. And by the way, it reads it the way that we read it. V'chein u'omer, machar anochi netzav ha'rosh ha'giv'ah. V'chein b'sho'u ke'et machar ishlach l'cha ish. V'zeh kanu machar isek ha'dvar ha'melech. Machar hu shesek ha'dvar ha'melech v'yesh omu shelo ita shumat lo. Okay, and we'll leave that. This midrash expresses this idea that we're victorious against Amalek. We're always victorious against them. Tomorrow. Okay, machar is a part of this. Yes, what happened?
No, is that related to Esau's?
Yes. Yes, of course. Of course. Of course. We'll get there in a second. She knows what she's saying. She knows what she's saying. Reen, I believe, is the longest standing attendee of this year. Yes. You get appreciated just for surviving, right? Which is not a simple thing. It's not a simple thing. Correct. We'll come back to that in a second, that there are elements of this right away between that thing that I already mentioned, and that is the Yaakov Esav discussion when he's buying the chilant. So let's go back. You'll notice in the story of Purim, when Haman comes back from the party the first day, there's going to be another one the next day, which, by the way, is when he's going to fall. And his wife actually tells him to go and put up the gallows, and then tomorrow go to the king. I actually stress this. Tomorrow. Machar. Tomorrow you'll go. Mañana. You'll wait. You'll go. And what does, of course, Haman do? He puts it up and he goes in the middle of the night, which is actually strategically a terrible death and most likely the reason why Ahasuerus was very suspicious of him anyway, because he doesn't like anybody showing up. Certainly you should not be showing up. The thing is, and it's not the time for now, if you want at some point, I'll give another shiur about that. Anybody who does have my new book on Purim, then you know that's the first chapter is about this, is that one of the things that I diagnosed, and this is not right that I diagnosed him, but I diagnosed Haman, aside from being narcissistic, to also being bipolar. And what happens is that he crashed. He sees Mordechai, and he's sky high. Then he sees Mordechai, and he crashes. And his wife wants to get him some therapy. So what kind of therapy do you get for an anti-Semite? Why don't you put up a gallows to kill a Jew? This will cheer you up. This is he can write this off on his tax returns. He wrote this up as therapeutic anti-Semitism. And we're laughing. Therapeutic anti-Semitism, because this is going to make him feel better. And she says, okay, and then you'll have a good day tomorrow. But what does he do, of course, once he gets manic? Then he goes running in the middle of the night because he's got all of this energy now because there's a Jew to be killed. Anyway, later on in the story, we also find in Perek Tet, source number 5, also Imelamelech Tov, Atoma Esther Imelamelech Tov, Yinatein Gam Machar Liyudim. There's another element of tomorrow over there where more of the anti-Semites will be killed. And source number 6 is where Zeresh, says correctly so, that if you start to fall, linpol, because remember that language in the Medrash, is they always fall tomorrow. So she actually prophesizes, oh, you're going to start to fall, you're going to fall, and this, of course, is finally the tomorrow. Now, the Sifte Kohen, which is somewhat of a Kabbalistic source, in source number 7, he tells you something that you should pay attention to, and again, we're going to see how far we can get with this, because we don't have unlimited time today. He points out that Machar, I don't know if you say the same gematria, it's easier than that, it's the same letters, it's an anagram of Rechem. Rechem, of course, is womb, and Machar is tomorrow. So a Rechem is a place that somebody is going to be born, where you actually, it's the place to prepare for tomorrow. So there is something interesting about those letters, and he then points out, again, correctly so, that Davar Acher, Avraham begematria, that Machar is 248. By the way, that itself should be interesting. There's 248 positive mitzvot. That's Machar. A lot of us say, yeah, I'll do them tomorrow. There's 248 positive commandments. That's Rechem. We learn all the Torah, Berechemima. But it's also Avraham when he gets the hay. Avraham now becomes 248. Avraham gets the mitzvah Brit Milah. At this point, Avraham gets the positive mitzvot as well. And so, and of course, the mathematicians among me will say, well, statistically, you know, something was going to work out. In source number 8, it's also the Sifte Kohen. By the way, what's the difference is one is he's talking over here, Perik Yud Zayin and Shmot, and what's that talking about? Of course, that's talking about the Mechama of Amalek, where this is our Machar. Tomorrow, either tomorrow Moshe's going to mount, or tomorrow you'll fight against Amalek, but either way, Amalek's going down tomorrow. And again, I'll just note this in passing, that those 2 days, Kaf Zayin and Kaf Chet, Iyar, were the 2 days that Jerusalem were liberated during the Six-Day War. Those are the same days. So at some point, tomorrow does happen. I just will note that. So in source number 8, it's also the Sifte Kohen, but now he's talking Shemot Perek Lamed Bet. What in the world is in Shemot Perek Lamed Bet? Answer, that's the Chet Egel. In the Chet Egel, there's also an aspect of Machar. Aaron says, you know, get all this ready, and tomorrow, Chag L'Hashem Machar. So here, he's back to the same Machar, which is really interesting, which means, you know, you go back to this thing that it's the Erev Rav there, and now suddenly you realize that those people pushed outside of the Machaneh, people outside of the Anani Yakovod, and the people who are doing the, I mean, these are the troublemakers who just went to war to save, yeah. And it's really interesting because he's using the same strategy which is used against Amalek, let's wait for the again, delayed gratification. You know, you need something, you need it now, chill, take it easy, calm down, and push them off to tomorrow. So it's really interesting, Aaron is using the same strategy. So over here, he goes a little bit further, and he says, oh, these are the same letters, Machar, Cherem, Cherem. Cherem, we're going to find this later on, it's going to be part of the problem with Shaul regarding the possessions of Amalek. You're not allowed to use those possessions. There was supposed to be a Cherem over there. Rechem, Ramach. So Ramach also, 248 mounts of mitzvot. Ramach is a sword, right? A dagger or exact translation. How would you translate Ramach? Dagger is good. We like dagger. So it's interesting he's pointing out this whole connection. Do we need anything else right here? No. The Keter Yonatan is the Targum Yonatan back in Hebrew in source number 9. All that he did, he reads what we already saw in the Mechilta back into the text, so you don't need this. Let's go back to the introduction of the whole problem. What's the starting point? I gave you a wrong starting point before. What's the starting point of the Mechama of Amalek? Well, Mechama of Amalek is the Jews against Amalek. What's the starting point? So the starting point, I already gave you a hint, and what was that? That was the Cholent and the Bechora, right? But that's not really the starting point. What's really the starting point? It's Yaakov and Esav. So what's the starting point? The starting point is in utero. By the way, how do you say utero in Hebrew? Rechem. Rechem. So the starting point is over there. And I'm going to show you a midrash, which is just completely crazy. But in source number 10, V'tzitzu, Habanim Bikirba. And I went looking over here right away because I didn't remember it saying Rechem at any point over here. The midrash does. That's what we'll see. But here is that V'tzitzu, Habanim Bikirba. What does it mean, Bikirba? B'toch Rachma, right? And then it says, V'yomar Hashem La, Shnei Goyim B'vitnech. So again, it in both cases here, it avoids that particular word. But look at source number 11. So again, if you want an extreme expression of the wickedness of Esav, even in utero, I know you already have, he wants to get out and go party by the Batei Avodah Zarah and so on. But look at source 11. Rachin Yatzachav, Achar Sheimlach Esav, Yimlach Yaakov. That again, there's this existential eternal battle. V'kamadu hu amar v'lu moshim b'har tzion, and so on. V'yado ochozit v'ekev esav. Shebikesh likroa rechem imo. Shelo yetze Yaakov misham. He wanted to rip out his mother's womb. Again, if you want to ascribe bad things to Esav, here's another one he never... But of course, what interested me the most in that particular formulation, it's talking about the Rechem. He wants to perform a hysterectomy on his mother while his brother is still inside. So you say, what in the... But I'm saying pay attention, because Machar and Rechem, and you need... Look, there's another point. What's really the battle that's taking place is who's going to come out first. What's actually the battle all the way along over here? The battle is who really is the Bechor. Who is the Bechor? Who's really the firstborn? So that's really what's taking place. The Ramban, where he says, Umato Eloha Bechora, right? Vayomo Vayacha Vayesh, Vayikam Vayelech Vayivaz, right? Esav de Bechora. At the very end, he says over here, Ki ein chafetz b'ksilim rak sheyachlu v'yishtu v'yasu chafetzam b'itam. Fools want to do everything immediately, v'lo yachushu l'yom machar, because they don't really believe in tomorrow. They want immediate gratification. They need everything right now. So essentially, what Esav does is he sells off his future for a bowl of chillens right now, and what Yaakov does is that he invests in the future. And just to really make sure we understand this, the investment in the future is taking upon himself 400 years of servitude and going down to Egypt and then coming out, and then finally the payday will come, and that is that they'll get the land of Israel. After they do all the hard work, and the Chizkuni and the Rush, various Balei HaTosfot point this out, that after the Am Yisrael does all the hard work, gets who shows up and says, Amalek is there, okay, we're willing now to take back our our destiny, the land of Israel, because that's ours. So therefore, no hard work, no investment. And you know what? If nothing else, we really, really are a people who believe in tomorrow. We're people who are willing to sacrifice our... Again, how many people in this room sacrificed their lifestyle for their children's education because they believe in tomorrow? I'm saying that's a way of expressing it, and it's real. Because other people, I want to spend my money. I want a better house. I want a nicer car. No, because we invest in the future, because we believe in the future. And we're people who've believed in the future for thousands of years. We believe in the future. And as bad as the present ever was... very painful, but we believed in the future. So it's interesting that they're about saying a fool is spending all of his money today because he just got paid, right? He's spending all of the money. He just got paid. He wants immediate gratification. He wants everything right now. And Yaakov understands in this. Yaakov understands and believes in Machar. So therefore, this in chapter 32 in Bereshit, which is when Yaakov and Esav are going to have their confrontation, we don't pay attention to it, but the 400 men are coming at Yaakov, then Yaakov goes to sleep, and the confrontation takes place, Machar. I'm just pointing out that we don't always note it, but it's there as well. It's great over there as well, now that we're keeping in mind about what happens Machar, in verse 15, Vayaretz Esav l'krato v'yichapkeu v'yipol tzavur v'yishakeu v'yipku. And they kiss and they embrace and they hug and they cry. And all that, by the way, is in plural. So look at Rashi. So again, I can't help, that word rechem, rachamav. Rachamav is the kind of love that a mother has for a child. And that's why it really would be translated as compassion. And at this point, Esav identifies with the compassion for his brother. So this is so great, because again, this comes from Chazal. It's so great. This man was willing to perform a hysterectomy on his mother before, but now the Rachamav. So these are the two sides. But I love the end of this. And of course, I'm going to say it with a little bit of a twist. He continues and he says, Amar Rav Shimon ben Yochai, halacha hi biyadu asha Esav son of Yaakov. Elo shenim karu Rachamav botoshav v'nashku b'chol libo. That it's a halacha that Esav hates Yaakov, but at this moment he then asks, "So what happened here? Why is he making up? What happened to Esav?" So he says that at this moment, yesh rachamim. Again, I think the answer is that the way that Shimon Bar Yochai put it, he said it's a halacha. Once Esav knew it's a halacha that he has to hate him, so then therefore he has to like him at this point, because he wants to, he can use this on Purim. Because it's a halacha. Once it's halacha, that's why he goes and he hugs and he kisses him, because Esav is such a rasha that he couldn't follow even that halacha. Anyway, getting back to our point, in 17 you see the cherem with Amalek. And I want to get to the last couple of sources, and I'm really going to speak them out. There is a Yerushalmi in source 19, which is codified by the Rambam, surprisingly, in source 18. And that is that Yemota Mashiach, the only book which will really be of relevance to us, is either only the story of Purim or the Chamesh Chumshei Torah and Purim. Rashi, Kol Sifrei Neviim, V'Kol HaKtuvim, again, not Chumash, Kol Neviim K'tuvim, Atidun Libatel Yemota Mashiach, Chutz Megillat Esther. The only book that's going to be relevant. Why? In the future. Why? Why? Because it's a book about tomorrow. That's what it's about. It's about it tomorrow. It's at some point we win. That's what Purim is. At some point we win. The whole, again, there's the strategy against Amalek is delay gratification that drives him crazy. Oh, you want a war? You want to fight? We'll come out tomorrow. Can you imagine they're banging the drums? They have the war paint on and then they're in a frenzy. We'll be there soon. Just, you know, start without us. Have a good time. We wait. Delayed gratification is how we fight them. But there's another message to this, and that is, and through this world, the Amaleks of the world have had a lot of success, and we could lose our faith when that happens. We could be frustrated when that happens. We could say, what are we going to do with ourselves when that happens? And what's the answer? We believe. And by the way, now you realize why Purim has to be 2 days. Right? Those of you in Yerushalayim, it has to be another. There's a machar. There is another day. Right? Then that's Esther asked for another day. But there is another day. Why? Because that's what it's about. It's always about machar. And Purim is about the future becoming the present. And sometimes it looks completely upside down. It looks completely confused. And everything doesn't make sense. And it's completely antinomian in all kinds of ways. But nonetheless, it's a belief in the future. It's the way to fight against Amalek, because they are in the present. It's a way to win against Amalek, and it's the story of Amalek, and it's the Rechem, and it's the Machar, and it's the Cherem, and it's the 248 mitzvot, and it's Avram Avinu, and it's the hill. It's Avraham. That was part of what that was telling us. But that's the victory against Amalek. The victory against Amalek is a story of tomorrow, that we get a glimpse of the future world. The glimpse of the future world is that we are victorious and we are celebrating. And look, this year, as I said, everything's a little different. You know, someplace in every one of our hearts, we're kind of hoping that certain people in Gaza who've been trying to kill us will suddenly be killed on Purim. We'll even settle for Shush on Purim, right? And by the way, there's a part of us that believes it's going to happen. We believe it's going to happen. No. So Kaddish Baruch, we just have to tell them, this is the book for the future. We already wrote the script, Bezrat Hashem, that the celebration that we have on Purim really will be a glimpse of the future, and that future should be very, very soon.